Over 43 million people in America grieve the loss of a cat or a dog each year. When adding the loss of a horse, a bird, and other exotics, a safe estimate is another 20 million new grievers each year, for a total of 63 million people per year in the United States alone. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, host of Mind Talk, and I'd like to welcome you to Transitions Tuesday. We all experience transitions in our lives, and today we're going to learn about another. My guest is Russell Friedman, and Russell is the co-author with Cole James and John W. James of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. Russell Friedman, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. What an honor to be with you and your audience.
Well, Russell, I got to start with a question. With potentially 63 million people per year just in the United States, in your view, why is there such a relative absence of information and attention being paid to the trauma of pet loss?
Well, we've got to start with the fact that grief itself, forget about pet loss for the second and go, grief is the most off-limits topic for conversation in the English-speaking Western world. Now, that's a statement that the founder of our organization, my partner, John W. James, was making 28 years ago when I joined him here at the Grief Recovery Institute. He had been making it for 7 years before. For 35 years, he's been saying that. Now, it isn't true anymore because of so much of the work he's done and I've done and our books have done to educate people. Grief is no longer the most off-limits topic for conversation, but, Pamela, grief recovery is still off-limits. Yeah. People will say grief now. On the news, you'll hear grief. You'll hear the word grief when there's a tragedy. You'll hear grief counselors are sent in.
Right.
So grief isn't as off-limits as it used to be, but recovery is still the bugaboo. Recovery is something, when people ask what I say I do grief recovery. I help people deal with death, divorce, and other losses. And they'll say to me, oh, I didn't know recovery was even possible. So we're still coming from behind the eight ball, and that's what we do 24/7. The rest of our country and our world has not caught up to the fact that while grief is a normal and natural reaction to loss, the things we learn about dealing with grief are not normal, not natural, not helpful. The purpose for the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss is to re-educate people to something that is normal and healthy, to guide them to actions that will help them as they deal with the heartbreaking, overwhelming loss of a pet, and we also help with all other losses as well.
Well, you know, as you're talking about just sort of grief generically, I'm reminded of a very recent conversation I had with someone who is grieving not the loss of a pet, but the loss of a relationship. And her point was, as you said, she believed that this is just something that you have to go through, and there's nothing to do but to go through it and to feel bad about it, and recovery was just not on her radar by any stretch. So you're absolutely right.
No, and she is unfortunately, typical.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure she's a bright and wonderful person, but here's what's typical. You and I and she and everyone else we know was socialized to believe that time heals all wounds,
right,
or that grief just takes time. Now, let's show why her waiting to feel better isn't an accurate thing to do. For example, if you get a flat tire, would you pull up a chair and sit down and wait for air to jump back in your tire?
Personally, I would.
I didn't think so. But it's a very funny way to start a show on grief, but it's the best example of a major problem. So what we know you would do one of two things. You'd go, oh, my goodness, this is why cell phones were invented. I will call the auto club and have them hurry over and get my tire fixed so I can go pick up the kids or take them to school or whatever I have to do. Or you might be one of those really self-oriented people, and you're going to dig around in the trunk and try to find that little donut thing they call a flat spare tire these days. Then you get out the jack and jack up the car and change the tire. And without one or two of those actions, you are not going anywhere, okay?
So Russell, are you telling me that I can't just sit in the chair and wait for the air to magically go back in the tire?
Well, if you can, you'll be the first, or the alternative, Pamela. This is a sad image. We come back 100 years later, and there's your skeleton in the chair with its clothes on, and guess what? The tire will still be flat.
Well, that's no fun.
Now, time doesn't do anything. It is what we do within time. Now, let's make a parallel or metaphor to grief, okay? Time won't fix your broken heart any more than time would fix a flat tire. Okay. It requires actions, okay, to fix your broken heart, to get your life back on the road. But if you don't know that, you wait to feel better.
Right.
I can tragically tell you, I've been doing this for 28 years, I have talked to literally tens of thousands of grieving people, whether they're dealing with a pet loss or a human loss or a divorce or whatever. And the vast majority of them called me and they say, when will I get to feel better?
Uh-huh.
And I say, well, have you done anything to feel better? No, then the answer, sadly, is never. And you have known people who have been telling a story over and over for years about a death, a divorce, a pet loss, and they just loop their story.
Yes.
And sadly, you've known people, and they're stuck, they're paralyzed. The tragedy is that need not be. But one of the reasons it happens is people have never been told what actions to take. The actions take change a flat tire, we know. Most people don't know what actions will help get their heart back on the road following loss. And that's what this book and all the work we do at Grief Recovery Institute is about, giving better information in a safe environment so people will learn the actions that will help them. It is that simple.
It is that simple, and yet it is that complicated in that, as you say, so many people do not approach grief from that perspective, and it's that critical to really be aware of.
I couldn't. Listen, you are so immaculate. I could not paraphrase what I said better. Thank you. I think you've made it clear to the audience exactly what we're saying here. Look, grief is the normal and natural reaction to loss. Okay, as happiness or joy is the normal and natural reaction to good news, our reaction to bad news or bad events is sad.
Right.
Okay, yet the vast majority of things we're taught about dealing with sadness are not correct. We teach our children to read and write, and we teach them how to acquire things and do math and make their life work, and yet loss, Pamela, is inevitable. If you live long enough, you will have a whole host of losses. It's impossible
indeed
to avoid loss. And yet what we're taught about dealing with it, and we've only focused on one of six major myths that we highlight at Grief Recovery, the myth of time healing. There are five others that are equally incorrect, equally limiting to people, and explain why and how people get stuck. So, look, I'm here at my office on a non-work day to talk with you with the hope of getting through to one heart, two heart, 1,000 hearts, 100,000 hearts, to give them better information. And,
well,
and you know, our books, are, we donate thousands of copies of our books to libraries. We don't care about getting people's money. We want to get them to get better information so they can do better to make their life work better.
Well, then I'm going to ask you to help walk us through the rest of those myths that you just identified. What is another myth that people labor under?
I'd be glad to. There is no actual order of the myths, although I tend always to do them in an order. It tends to be the same order we write about them in the books. And the foundation myth is one that it may or may not surprise you. Let me present it this way. Imagine a little girl or a little boy, but we'll use a little girl, has come home from preschool with tears in her eyes, and the very alert parent sees the tears and the body language of their little child they love, and they say, "What happened, honey?" And the little girl, trusting her parent, says, "The other little girls were mean to me." At which point, the mother makes a colossal error, even though she loves her child. She says, "Honey, quote, don't feel bad. Here, have a cookie. You'll feel better," unquote. Now, question, does the cookie make the child feel better, or
None.
Does it make the child feel different? Pamela, I'll give you a guess on that.
I'm thinking maybe different.
I'm thinking you're right on. And so what we have done is distract that child with a substance, right. Sugar in that case. It's either usually either cookie or ice cream. You'll never, by the way, just for fun, because I'm involved with a 22-month-old granddaughter, you'll never hear someone say, "Don't feel bad. Here, have some broccoli. You'll feel better."
That's very true.
Never will. So we use substance. And the implication is that if you eat this, you'll feel better. But what, if anything, have we done to address the issue of hurt feelings on the playground? Nothing.
Right.
On the other hand, we have established as an authority, as you the mom, me the dad, we have established from our authority position with our child that we medicate feelings with food.
Right.
And it gets buried away. It gets sorted and filed in the child's unconscious mind and conscious. Now, let's fast forward 10, 11 years. Now this little girl is a teenager, and her first boyfriend broke up with her, and she's moping across the playground, and someone says, "Hey, don't feel bad. Here, try this. You'll feel better." Right. And they will hand her a joint or a beer or some other substance.
It's
now,
true.
Where did she learn to use substances to medicate or modify her feelings? From her own parents who love her. Now,
right. Please,
you and everyone listening, hear me. This is not an attack of parents or society or culture. This is an attack on misinformation about dealing with loss. Now, I hate to present a problem and not a solution, so watch this.
Okay.
Imagine, and I want everybody listening to imagine, unless you're driving a car, I want you to even copy what I'm about to say. So you're with a little child, someone in your care. You're a guardian, a grandparent, a parent, a friend, a teacher, and a little child says, "The other little girls were mean to me." Now, I want to ask everyone listening to think about this. Did any of you ever have your feelings hurt when you were a little boy or a little girl? And we know the answer is yes. I mean, have you ever met anyone who didn't have their feelings hurt? So, having had a life experience that's somewhat parallel, if different, from what this child is saying, what you do, and I want you to imagine this, you put your hand on your heart, and you say, "Oh, honey, your little heart must feel so sad." Now, it indicates that you heard the child
Indeed.
And heard what she said.
Indeed.
She said, "My feelings were hurt." Now, instead of saying, "Don't feel the way you feel,"
right. Which
implies that her feelings are wrong or bad, okay? She's being told, "Oh, wow, I hear you loud and clear. It sounds so sad." And then you pause for a second, Pamela, and you say, "And I remember when I was a little girl or I was a little boy, I remember having my feelings hurt, and I didn't like it at all." Now, is that true? Of course it's true. So now we have acknowledged hearing the child. Most of the time, they don't need a sugar reward for that.
Right.
They're ready to go, "Okay, goodbye." They're ready to go and play. Every once in a while, depending on the individual kid and their age and maturity and so on, they may have a need to tell the story. "Well, Nancy hit me and Mary did this." And you may have to go through the story, but we always say this, heart first, story second. I want the heart line, not the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
When the kid is crying and said the other little girls are mean to me, that's an emotional presentation.
Right.
Let's react to what they're saying. Let's look at that flat tire and deal with it rather than modifying it and turning it into something else which distracts. Now, this is really important in the area of pet loss because although we never want to compare or segregate grievers, whether it's the death of a human, death of a pet, or a divorce, or any other loss. But the fact is, I personally believe, 28 years into doing this, that grieving pet owners are maybe the most mistreated group of people on planet Earth.
Certainly you and I know that there are often lots of people and places and thoughts about how to respond to someone who has grieved the loss of a human being. But pet, those who lose a pet, I'm thinking are very much alone in their own grief. Is that correct or no?
It is so correct that when we were just talking about the basic myth of don't feel bad, it is actually the cornerstone of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. If you open that book, the very first chapter is entitled Don't feel bad. It was only a dot, dot, dot. That's right. The chapter heading, and that's where you would insert dog, cat, horse, bird. Okay? And so it's that powerful that the grieving pet owners are hit always. I mean, I never met a grieving pet owner who didn't call me and said, thousands of people had already told them not to feel bad when they were feeling horrible. Now, even before we go further into that, okay, imagine this. Imagine you and I are friends, Pamela, and you call me one day, say, hi, it's Pamela. I say, hi, how you doing? You say, things are great. Things are great. It's my radio program. Things are great at home. My life is just fabulous. Now, can you imagine me saying, don't feel good? I mean, doesn't that sound stupid? Yeah. Now, but if you call someone and say, my favorite aunt died, the first thing out of their mouth is, well, don't feel bad. She's in a better place.
Right.
Well, maybe she's in a better place. Maybe your dog or cat is in a better place. But here's the operative question. Who is not in a better place? And that's the griever.
Exactly.
But the first thing a grieving pet owner hears is don't feel bad. Now, let me show you just how absurd that is.
Sounds like you got busyness in your background.
Yes, there's a fire engine going by. Don't feel bad is the opening of that chapter. On the same page, it says this: imagine that your mother died and mm-hmm. someone came up to you and said, don't feel bad, it was only a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel bad, it was only a mother. That's written right on the page.
Yeah,
you imagine? It would make you homicidal if someone said, justifiably, if someone said that to you. And yet, when you have a pet die, they say, don't feel bad, it was only a dog. Now, the word only, I could probably do an hour program on the word only for grieving pet owners.
Yeah.
What that means, how it minimizes. Now,
indeed,
everyone listening to us today who has a pet or has had a pet or has had a pet die knows how debilitating, how minimizing that word only is.
Absolutely.
As if to say, you stupid woman, how silly of you to have an emotional relationship with an animal. I mean, oh my God, it was only a dog. When you indicate righteously and rightfully that grieving pet owners tend to isolate in our society,
yes,
wouldn't you isolate if the vast majority of things you heard from alleged friends and family was, don't feel bad, it was only a dog?
Right.
How safe would you feel to talk openly about your feelings, your emotions, the bond, the connection, the unconditional love?
Not at all.
With your pet?
Not at all.
Not so much.
Right.
So without missing a beat, let's just jump from myth number one, although they're not in order, to myth number three, which is grieve alone.
Mm.
And let's talk about how that happens to us and to the people around us. You and I were all socialized, and everybody listening, with a dangerous cliche. It says, laugh and the whole world laughs with you.
Right.
Cry and you cry
alone.
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 So, it is not nature or natural to grieve alone, Pamela. When you get good news, what is the very first thing you want to do?
You tell somebody.
Hello, and what do you think your natural instinct is to do the very moment you get sad or bad or painful news?
You want comfort from somebody. You want to tell somebody.
You want to tell someone. It is a 1,000% parallel. But if you have been socialized with, Pamela, if you're going to cry, go to your room. Knock off that crying, or I'll give you a reason to cry. Laugh and the whole world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. You have been taught to isolate your sad, painful, or negative feelings. The only aspect of Pamela that we want out here on public view is the happy, sweet, you know, the world is my oyster, Pamela.
Exactly.
But that's not the 24/7 Pamela.
Mm-hmm.
That's Pamela sometimes, and most of the time even. But if I don't have the freedom to express my sad, painful, or negative feelings safely, okay, where are they going to go? Do they just disappear?
Right.
If they just disappeared, guess what? There would be no jobs for any therapists or social workers or psychiatrists in our world. Everyone would be mentally healthy. They would have emotionally healthy. They would have no problems. You have a feeling? No, I have no feelings about that. It was only a dog.
Right.
Or it was only a mother.
Right.
I mean, it's just crazy.
It is.
So my job is to undo the craziness and show correct information, safe environment, and, you know, and hopefully with these examples we're making today, some little metaphors and examples to say something more emotionally logical, something more reasonable. And as much as I really want to talk to the members of your audience who are or might someday be grieving pet owners, I equally want to talk to all the other listeners who have never had a pet, who don't have a kind of a consciousness or awareness about mm-hmm. what it might be like, because they are the people who accidentally hurt friends and family who are grieving pet owners just by saying things that they presume to be helpful and soothing but aren't. And so, you know, we will spend as much time as we can on things to say and not say that are helpful. Look, we love our friends, we love our family. When we're trying to be there for them, quote unquote, we need some better language and better information. That's what we're up to here today.
Well, let me ask you this, because I have certainly heard people say in the losing of a pet, you can always get another one. When are you going to get a new one?
Are you talking about the number two myth, which is replace the loss? Oh my gosh, Pamela, I think you are.
I think I looked at your book.
Look, by the way, no one said grief recovery can't be fun. In fact, it's not about a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. It's just life and relationships, relationships with animals, relationships with people have sweet, they have sour, they have happy, they have silly. And we have all that here today because we represent, you and I, our humanness and our feelings about animals and other creatures too. Sure. So let's go to replace the loss. In the original version of the Grief Recovery Handbook, not the Handbook for Pet Loss,
okay,
John W. James self-published a book he wrote in his typed in his garage, and this was 35 years ago. And the opening story is not about death of a human. It was when John was about 7 years old, mm-hmm. and his dog Peggy died, and John, as a little boy, was crushed. John, and I have his permission to break his anonymity or the family's, John grew up in a raging alcoholic household. His father was a violent drunk, and the only safe entity in the house for John was his dog, Peggy. The mother was at war with the father. His older brother was in a war with the father. And John, as a little boy, the only entity he could talk to, tell the truth to, be safe with, was Peggy. And Peggy died, and John was crushed.
I would think.
And his family said, "Don't feel bad, son. On Saturday, we'll get you a new dog," which mm-hmm. is replace the loss.
Right.
But John didn't want a new dog. First of all, he's a little boy. What did he want? He wanted Peggy back. And
right.
of course, even though he had one part of him at seven, he knew you couldn't get a dead animal back. But he didn't want a new dog. And without knowing that he was going to wind up creating the Grief Recovery Institute and the Grief Recovery Method, he instinctively said, "I don't want to connect to another dog and get my heart hurt again." Because he didn't know how to deal with the hurt he had.
Right.
The only guidance he was getting from his family was, "Don't feel bad. We'll get you a new dog."
Right. Don't feel it.
None of that matched up.
Right.
It didn't work for him. So this whole idea of replace the loss, and I'm going to tell you, and people listening may have heard of this, and please don't ever do this. I can't tell you how many thousands of people have called me. They had a dog or cat die. Other animals too, but particularly with dogs and cats. And the next day, a well-meaning friend or family member
yes.
shows up at their house
yes.
with a brand-new puppy or kitty. Now, it's obscene. That's the only one. Imagine your husband dies. Someone comes the next day to your house with a guy for you to date. I mean, excuse me. Hello?
Yeah.
Body, and without getting cruder, the body's not warm in the ground yet or cool in the ground, and we have people bringing replacement parts.
Right.
Excuse me.
Right.
When do we get to grieve and deal with our feelings and the broken connection and blah, blah, blah? When do we do that? So this idea of replace the loss gets taken in the pet world, gets taken to extremes, usually larger. Although, look, after you've been widowed or divorced for a few weeks or a few months, people will start, doing the dating thing for you.
Exactly.
And telling you got to lose weight and get your hair done and get a new outfit and so on. If you're a woman, men, they'll give men the parallel advice, all of which is incorrect, because you are not ready to attach your life to another human being any more than you're ready to attach your life to another pet
exactly.
until you have effectively dealt with the emotions attached to it.
Russell, I got to ask you a question. You are so passionate about this whole area of grief recovery. How do you come to have such passion and energy around something that, as you said, for a very long time, people didn't even really want to talk about.
You know, if I was anywhere near you, I would just offer you a hug. That is the most delightful question. And I love your use of the word passionate as it relates to how I am about this. I think it is a composite reaction to the grief I had in my childhood, especially in dealing with my father, who lived to be 90-something, in the way he treated me. I had the grief of feeling different than all other kids. I had red hair and freckles, and that sounds cute, but when you're, you know, that I had a billion freckles. I was also younger in school than all the other kids. So I had a host of things that happened that set me up not to deal well with grief.
Yeah.
And at every turn when I tried to talk about it, I was stopped. Okay, I was told, you know, don't cry, don't feel bad, go to your room, all like that. Big boys don't cry,
right.
You know, grieve alone, time will heal. I was taught all the same myths everyone else was. So when I finally got to the Grief Recovery Institute in my early 40s, and on the heels of a second divorce and a bankruptcy for $500,000, this was 28 years ago.
Oh, my.
Something clicked that said, pay attention. I was listening to this fellow, John W. James, who's now my partner, at a one-day overview, and something clicked. And it was like the missing link for me. So I think what the passion you hear, the energy you hear in me, and part of the energy is this. Unresolved grief drains energy and robs choice.
It does.
Let me say that again. Unresolved grief drains energy and robs choice. And you've seen grieving pet owners and grieving human owners and grieving divorcees have very little energy because it just sucks it out of you. The result of grief recovery, the actions of grief recovery applied to a pet loss or a human loss, help you get back the energy that's being drained even while you're sleeping, that's just working away, okay? And so part of my passion is energy, and the energy is based on having gotten the freedom to address my grief directly when and as it happens and when there are reminders of losses, as we all had last week on 9/11.
Yeah.
I'm a little different than most on 9/11 itself. I got a call, and I had to rush over to Channel 5 here in Los Angeles, and I was on the live air on the TV for 4 hours that afternoon on a major television station. And in front of me, Pamela, were banks of monitors, which means I saw the buildings coming down, the planes crashing, and the people jumping. I saw them thousands and thousands of times. And, you know, to this day, I can't watch any of the footage of 9/11. It's so burned an image in my brain.
Absolutely. I think for us all.
What that day did for all of us is remind us of the incredible fleeting nature of life. That anyone, and I, you know, maybe more than others, I'm here at this desk in my office every day getting calls from people where their husband or wife walked out the door and never came back, had a heart attack or an auto accident or something happened. And what 9/11 did remind us to cherish our relationships every moment we have, because we don't know when the moment will be over. And I've never seen that any truer than our relationship with our pets. Because of the unique relationship we have with our pets, the reminder to cherish them, to honor them, to speak to it directly with the pet, but also with other humans, is never larger. And then the loss is when I have all this feeling about my pet who died and the people around me won't listen to me. They won't let me talk about my love for my pet. Am I missing him? Am I, you know, just the stories I have that need to be shared. And so again, for those listening, what I want you to do, if you're not the grieving pet owner, but a friend of someone, I want you to get up, take the image of being a heart with ears. I want you to listen with your heart, not your head. I want you to allow your friend. Now, I'm not saying you have to be a therapist or do anything magical. Just listen.
Right.
Say, oh, wow, thanks for sharing. And, you know, you don't have to do it for hours at a time, but just give them a moment to tell you how they feel at that moment. You will do them more service than anything you could ever do.
Russell, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will pick up right here. Russell, there were many things that are addressed in the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss that I was actually surprised to see. So I'm curious to learn more about the method that you actually talk about. You talk about reviewing your relationship. You talk about completion. You talk about graphs and charts. Let's get into that in a bit more detail.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just before we do, I want to introduce something that happens to be a little bit funny, but it has more profundity than humor. There's a chapter heading in the book that says, remember, your pet never said you were fat, ugly, or stupid. And the reason it's there is to explain that sense of unconditional love we have. You come home, I come home, my dog wags his tail, I think it's going to come off his body. He's so excited to see me. And I say to my wife, I say, honey, would you do that one time when I came home? And she goes, not on your Nelly. And I also have a favorite prayer, and I'm sure everyone listening will love this. Lord, please let me be half the man my dog thinks I am. And so, but a part of this is explains the grief that we feel, the love we feel when the physical connection ends via death or a pet is lost, you know, runs away and doesn't come back. The impact that has on us emotionally is way bigger than a bread box. It's huge. Yeah. And that's why having it be dismissed by don't feel bad and replace the loss and time heals is just silly. So now to your question, the mechanics of recovery. And I don't even like the word mechanics because it's all about emotion.
Sure.
Grief is about a broken heart, not a broken head. But in order to help ourselves become emotionally complete with our pet who died, which is the thing that will then allow us to choose, if we want, to get another pet. And let's talk about that for a second. If I am married and I get divorced, or if I'm married and my spouse dies, I might at some point want to remarry. Right. It's never a good idea to remarry until I have done some really effective emotional work about the relationship with my spouse who died or is no longer there. Well, it is equally important to grieve and complete your relationship with your dog who died before you get a new dog. Lest you try to make the new dog be the old dog, and it can't. Every dog or every cat or every horse is unique. They have their own persona. And when you try to plug them in to the replace the loss and be like the other animal whole, you have destroyed the relationship. You sabotage it in the same way. If you're going to be my wife and I try to get you to be like my ex-wife, that's going to sabotage that. We'll wind up in divorce also. So I just want to get that out there. Therefore, in order to do things that will help you feel emotionally complete and then allow you to choose, if you do, to get another pet, you must take some actions. If you knew what the actions were, we wouldn't need this book.
Right.
The reason most people don't know the actions of recovery, Pamela, is what they know is don't feel bad, time heals, grieve alone.
And here's a replacement.
Right. None of which are helpful.
Right.
None of those help the griever. So after the first action of the grief recovery method in pet loss is to remove the issues that are involved with these myths, okay, and in their place put actions that help. Now, the review. Some people come to the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss having only had recently a single pet die. They don't have a lifetime of losses. On the other hand, a huge percentage of people have had pets die over the years because for most, not all, most domestic animals live much shorter lifespans than we do.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're 40, 50, 60, you may have had 5, 6, 7, 8 dogs that have died having lived their full complement of years. Doesn't mean you're not heartbroken, even if they live their full meter, so to speak. But what happens is what you learn when your first pet died, like what John learned at age 7 that crippled him, was don't feel bad, on Saturday we'll get your new dog.
Right.
And you have to look back at your history of grief, okay, as it relates to pets, and what you learned, because what you learned is what you do. Now, listen to this line, Pamela. In a crisis, we go back to old behavior or old belief, which means if your pet dies, you go back to, well, don't feel bad. You know, tomorrow's another day, and he's in a better place, and time will heal me, all of which is nonsense. So we, after we remove that nonsense, we have to look at our individual history of pet losses to see what we learned, what we know, and in many cases, dismiss some things we thought were true and now we realize aren't. That's one of the purposes of the book. Then we make a choice after doing all of this, which is not a huge task. It takes a few days of work to do.
Okay.
Can it be emotional? Yes, it can. So we always say have a box of tissues when you're doing this work, you know, because you need to be emotionally truthful, okay? Does it hurt? I don't know. Does it have some feeling? Probably. And then the next thing you're going to do is choose of the pets that have died. Are you going to work on the most recent one or one from earlier in your life? And that will be a choice that you will make based on the impact that death had on you and how much it's affecting you now. And then we walk you through a process in which you review the relationship with the pet that died. And my relationship with my dog, Buddha, who was a Hungarian Vizsla, okay, who died 11 years ago, is the example, and it's a very graphic example, not graphic in a bad way, just very specific examples of events that happened with my dog, some that were sweet, wonderful, and funny, some that were sad, painful, and negative. And it shows how to deal with each of the things.
Okay.
Like my dog one time tore up the inside of my car when I had left him alone for like 2 minutes, even with the windows open. He just panicked. And I had to forgive him. It could cost me $900 to replace the header in the car.
Oh, my.
You know? And I also had to apologize to the dog for leaving him in the car. I mean, there's a mixture of emotions attached to events. So, and when what I go through is to discover and complete. And here's the only six words anyone ever needs, Pamela, to get this work done. There are always things we wish had been different.
That's true.
Better. Or more in any relationship with any animal we've ever had,
or people.
More means And then the other three words are the unrealized hopes, dreams, and expectations about the future. If you have a pet you love, and even if they live their full life expectancy, is it ever enough for you? Of course not.
Right.
Okay, so in using those six words, different, better, more, hopes, dreams, expectations, we help you discover and then emotionally complete what was left unfinished for you by their death. That's what we mean by emotional completion. Not just looping stories of how much pain you feel.
Mm-hmm.
You do a story about your relationship with the person and then put it in a communication format to be heard by another living human being so that you can feel complete and stop looping the pain like a hamster on the wheel. That's the trap. People telling the story over and over make them good at pain. It doesn't make them good at recovery.
Right.
And that's the transition here from grief to recovery to completion. Now, does being complete mean you forget your pet? No, I can talk to you. If you got all day, I can talk to you all day about Buddha and the wonderful things he did and the horrible things he did. I can bore you to tears with Buddha stories. But on the other hand, I can just miss him from time to time, remember him. Even though my dog Baxter, who I got several months after Buddha died, is the same breed, but they're totally different personalities, they're totally different individuals. But I had the freedom to move forward and engage in an incredible relationship with my new dog because I got emotionally complete with my old dog. And notice, I don't forget my old dog. I don't lose him by doing the completion. I get the freedom to make a choice to have another pet.
Well, let me ask you this, because you've just said that you have Baxter, and Baxter is actually the same breed that you had. I would think that it would take a lot of work to really be able to recover and separate the fact that they're the same breed, but they're different.
Absolutely. Great point. Well taken. And the answer is yes. That is exactly what I needed to do. And it's exactly what I see a lot of people not doing.
Yes.
And there's something that needs to be said here in fairness. I'm very involved in the dog world. My dog and I are agility champions. We've been at the Nationals last year in Orlando. We have six mock championships, MACH. And a lot of people tend to be breed-centric. if Baxter now is 11, if he dies, you know, and if I go through, when I go through the completion, my wife and I would probably choose another Vizsla. We like that breed.
I love
that breed.
Okay.
But by doing the grief recovery, we get to have an individual Vizsla, not one who's replacing the one who's gone. You know, it's just we just happen to love that breed for a lot of reasons. So your point, totally well taken. But it's really a point for the audience, too. It's perfectly okay to stay with a breed that you love, but you got to do the emotional completion, because otherwise you're stuck trying to get the new dog to be like the old dog. And that's not fair to the new dog.
Or to you.
Exactly. Boy, you are good. It is not fair to either party.
The way in which people from the outside looking in tend to minimize the loss of a pet as being the loss of, I don't know, a pencil.
I hear you.
What would you like for the non-pet owners? I mean, we've been talking about it, but is there anything else that you would like the non-pet owner to really think about in terms of how he or she can support the friend who may, in fact, be devastated, particularly, I would think, if it's a sudden loss? You know, if there was an accident or an unanticipated illness. I would think that would be even more difficult, but I don't know. Am I on the right track?
You're on track. There's two different issues involved, but yes, after a long-term illness with a cancer and thousands of dollars and the pain and the ups and downs, there's one kind of set of feelings in addition to the relationship with the pet. And then with sudden loss, like an auto accident or something, an unexpected quick thing, there might be some additional feelings. Also, often, a lot of feelings about how the vets or vet techs treated them, how emotionally, you know, either positive or negative. So there's a lot of stories wrapped up in it. But to answer the first part of your question, I tried to do that earlier. Let's do it again. If you're the person who's got a friend or family member who had a pet die, and let's assume you've never been a pet owner and don't know much about how that might be. What you got to do is listen with your heart, not your head. Okay. Remember, they got a broken heart, not a broken head. Mm-hmm. Listen without judgment or criticism. Do not give advice. Unsolicited advice robs dignity. Don't ever tell someone not to feel bad.
Okay.
Don't. And by the way, if you have had a pet die, please don't ever say, "I know how you feel." Because every relationship is unique, you never actually know how someone else feels. Don't rob people of that. But one thing I can say to the non-pet owners, I want you to look inwards, and I want you to think about any losses you've had. If you had a parent die or a grandparent die, or if you had a divorce, anything that ever made you feel sad. And when you go inward into your own heart and soul and remember what it was like to feel bad, and remember that when you were trying to talk to people about how you felt, they told you, don't feel bad or grieve alone or time heals. I want you to think about how it felt to be dismissed like that. And that will guide you in not dismissing your friends who had a pet die. Look, here's a realistic thing, Pamela, and I know you know this. There are an awful lot of people, couples, who don't have children for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. They're medically incapable or whatever. Their wife didn't plan out that way.
Yeah, tons of reasons.
And their dogs become surrogate children. Is that bad? Of course not. I think, you know, my observation being around the dog world and people like that is many of us, not all, have a drive to be parents, to procreate, to be parents, to guide. It's just kind of built into our DNA. Otherwise, look how many billions of children there are. And when we get robbed of that or don't choose that, I think it's still active in a lot of people. So those couples for whom they're dog or cat or a bird is their child, please don't dismiss that. Please don't judge that. It is their way of processing a human set of feelings to be something, to be part of the process of life, and I honor that completely. their grief is as pure as mine was when my dog died, even though I have a daughter, I have a granddaughter, I have a spouse, I have a full life, but I was still heartbroken. Please
Absolutely.
Don't ever judge anyone's heartbreak.
A critical point to make. Thank you for that. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about short-term energy relieving behaviors. Folks, you're listening to Mind Talk Transitions Tuesday. Don't go away. Russell Friedman, co-author with Cole James and John W. James of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. You have to explain what a short-term energy-relieving behavior is. You refer to them as STERBs. What is that?
Okay, a STERB, short-term energy-relieving behavior, is anything we do, an action activity, in an attempt to deal with the feelings that are making us sad or affecting our lives. But it's a short-term energy-relieving behavior because it doesn't directly affect the thing. Let's give you an idea. You and I are friends. One night we go out to dinner. We get in an argument about politics. We leave. The evening ends with us kind of very angry at each other. I storm off, slam the door of my car. You slam off. You go home. I go home. I get home to my apartment, and I eat a gallon of Rocky Road ice cream. I'm so angry at you and what happened. What, if anything, have I done to deal with my direct feelings about my friendship with you? Answer?
Not a lot.
Nothing.
Right.
So eating the ice cream in that situation is a STERB. It does affect me in the short term. It's like comfort food. It removes me from my feelings about you. It covers them up. And by the way, look how parallel it is to don't feel bad here, have a cookie. You
right.
feel
You're
better.
Exactly right.
Exactly, and it has done nothing to deal with my real issues. My friend Pamela, I love her, but now I just want to kill her, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so eating is the primary number one short-term energy-relieving behavior. There are others. Alcohol would obviously be one, but there'll mm-hmm. be one that'll surprise you. Workaholism. How about this one? Retail therapy, also known as shopping. That's a big STERB for grievers. Internet, but even just watching a movie, TV, reading a book, all of which are wonderful. There's nothing wrong with reading a good escapist novel or watching a TV show. But when we do them in an illusion that we're dealing with the feelings, they don't work.
Right.
They don't. If I get mad at you and we have a fight, I go home and I watch a movie, does that do anything for you and me? No. If something happened between you and me, I must take a direct action. First, I might take an indirect one and talk to a friend or a sponsor or someone and just kind of clear the air about what I did or what you did and so on. But then I got to pick up the phone. Pamela, it's me. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what I said and, and how I said it. I'm humbly sorry. I don't say I'm sorry for my part. I say I'm sorry because I'm saying I'm sorry for my part is conditional. That means you have to be sorry, too. And that's not a real apology. So I have to do something. We all do STERBs. Some STERBs are more difficult and problematic than others. If you get into the habit of using food to medicate your feelings,
right,
then you wind up with a major eating issue, either an eating disorder or being massively overweight, which gives you a huge chance for a heart attack or stroke. So there are no negatives. And all the negative things that can happen when we do STERBs, you do the shopping as a way of dealing with feelings, you're going to go broke. You're going to lose your money.
Right.
Okay? If you become a workaholic, you rob yourself from your family and spouse and everything. Now you may lose them because you're not there.
Right.
So STIRBs don't help. We need to do direct things. One of the other major purposes for the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss is to guide people to direct actions rather than the indirect action of a STIRB. Okay? Look, people can go to our website, www.griefrecoverymethod.com. Under the blogs and articles section, there's a full-length article about STIRBs. There's all kinds of helpful articles they can download for free. It doesn't cost anything. You can spend hours reading the things I've written over the years. Okay,
wonderful.
You can order the books there. But then again, our books are in libraries, so you don't have to spend any money. I want everyone listening to get better information. And if they recognize, oh my gosh, I keep doing a STIRB and I keep having to do it because I haven't finished what was unfinished, so I'm just looping. It really is hamster on a wheel. You know, the eating, the sometimes drugging. By the way, anger is a big short-term energy-releasing behavior.
Uh-huh.
You can't complete anger. Prayer, as wonderful as prayer might be, prayer can also be a STIRB. We can misuse prayer. That may sound awkward, but it's true. So we have to make sure the things we're doing have a value and purpose. And rather than just moving some energy around, it's like venting. You know, people who vent, they
sure.
explode. Or they go to some sort of support group and they talk about how bad they feel. And they come back next week and talk about how bad they feel. And years later, they're talking about how bad they feel.
Yeah.
Because talking about your grief doesn't make recovery. Remember, in the beginning of the show, I talked about the transition from grief to grief recovery.
Absolutely.
I'm not in the grief business. I'm in the recovery business. How do I get to feel different or better than I do in the aftermath of losses that have affected me?
Russell, I'm going to ask you to give that website again, if you would.
I would. www.griefrecoverymethod.com. And again, there's a whole host of things there. By the way, for those people struggling with grief, you can find a specialist finder where you can put in your zip code and find the name and address and email of one of our certified specialists around the country. Hopefully, we have one in your community. We now have a program that they're teaching for pet loss. So
wonderful.
You can go to a six-week group once a week and do the work in the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. You can do the work in there with a tour guide, as it were, a trained facilitator, and with other people. Grief recovery, by the way, Pamela, tends to work better in group. It can be done one-on-one, but there's something in the group dynamic that can be incredibly valuable, you know, not feeling so isolated and alone.
And, you know, the other thing that I'm hearing continually throughout your conversation, which, because time has flown by, is about to end, is the need to be compassionate towards self. If you have lost a pet, be compassionate with yourself. And sometimes I will say to folks I'm working with, pretend you're a friend to yourself versus the way you actually treat yourself, and allow that compassion to flow through. Let yourself feel those feelings. They're human. They're real. You don't have to hide them.
Listen, again, all I want to do is jump through this phone and hug you. You so get it. And all I would do, without minimizing, I agree 1,000%, I would just add the other word I use in that same vein. Be very gentle with yourself. Mm-hmm. In addition to compassion, I love the word gentle because I watch people being so hard on themselves
Indeed.
About their feelings.
Indeed.
Be gentle. So let's, if we put compassion and gentle together, that'll be the name of our new company.
We got it. Russell Friedman, co-author with Cole James and John W. James of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. They are the creators of the Grief Recovery Method. Thank you so very much, Russell, for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
My pleasure. Big hug.
Thank you, and I'm going to send another one back your way. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and I thank you as well for listening to this edition of Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. You can listen to this program again and all Mind Talk programs on demand at myndtalk.org. Montauk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional of your choosing. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. And always remember, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.